Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 511. In this episode, Scott talks with coworker Damian Edwards about ASP.NET Core.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Damian Edwards. He is, in fact, my coworker. This is an unusual show because I'm going to be asking some questions that I do know the answer to, but in fact, a lot of them I don't. Thanks for talking to me today, Damian.
Of course.
So you run the ASP.NET team, or you're the PM, or you're the lead what?
Yeah, I have a terrible title. My title is a program manager.
Is it really? Is that true? It's not like manager lead or something?
No. My title is principal PM manager, and the PM is short for program manager. And so, it's manager.
Okay. So, that's a really good segue into a discussion of how Microsoft sucks at naming stuff.
Yeah, it is actually.
Really suck at naming stuff? Is that basically the deal?
Let's face it, everyone sucks at naming stuff. Like, naming is hard, and naming is the most subjective topic you can pick on the planet. Like, there are objective parts to everything, okay? And you can make some fairly objective arguments about naming, but when it comes down to it, what anyone sort of reads into a name and what they think of a name is pretty much purely subjective. And so, You're going to alienate. It's always polarizing. And so, like any sort of good political type of thing, we do our best to appease as much as we can all parties when we come up with names. And sometimes we get it wrong, and sometimes we have a chance to improve things. I'm not going to say correct. You know, I would like to say we can correct things, but we can improve them.
I said naming is hard in a blog post yesterday, and you know, I thought that was a pretty clear statement. And then some people on Twitter are like, is it hard? Really? You know, like, I don't know. It's frustrating because it seems like people feel that they could just pull a name, you know,
I know,
out of thin air and it would be better. But anyway, so what's going on with ASP.NET 5?
So we have decided, after a bunch of very valid feedback, that one of the most confusing parts about ASP.NET 5 was the 5 bit. The fact that 5 is larger than 4, funnily enough, which was the last version of ASP.NET that we shipped, as ASP.NET is currently known, it leads to some confusion. And so, I think as you pointed out in your post, like, 5 implies that it is a new version of 4, it is bigger, it covers more things, it is the next, you know, version, and if you have 4, you should move to 5. That's really not what reflects reality with what we're trying to do with what was ASP.NET 5. So, we've renamed it to something new, and we've reset the version number to 1. And so, we're now calling it ASP.NET Core 1.0.
Okay, so there's ASP.NET 4.5 and MVC and all those things continue to exist. And theoretically, could there be an ASP.NET 5 in the future?
Oh, of course. In theory, there's nothing technically preventing that.
Mm-hmm. So then this would mean that it could be potentially confusing from a Google, you know, Google Juice perspective. Like, people out there Googling for stuff are going to be, if they search for ASP.NET 5, they're currently going to find a bunch of beta stuff and a bunch of Stack Overflow questions.
So I think history has shown that generally those types of issues are point-in-time issues. Like, for example, Microsoft had a product called Surface that existed for a number of years that was somewhat, you know, category-defining. It defined its own category and had pretty good Google foo because you searched for Microsoft Surface and you got the big ass table. And then in one foul swoop, we came out and said Microsoft Surface is now an iPad competing tablet. And, you know, for a day or so, people thought that was ridiculous. And now we look back on that, and no one really blinks an eyelid at that. And if you search for Microsoft Surface, you'll get, you know, the current generation product. And I think there are probably other examples of that as well. And I really don't think that's going to be an issue.
Yeah. Google Juice kind of works itself out. I think the other thing that's worth pointing out, and I'd be interested if you agree, is that there's a whole class of people who simply aren't paying attention to any of this. Like, it may seem like a tempest in a teacup. You know, it's a big deal to everyone who's, you know, if you're following the daily builds and the commit messages of the GitHub of ASP.NET, this all seems very bad. But the average Joe and Jane developer, for every one of us, there's 1,000 of them, they probably don't really care.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. At the end of the day, things can seem, I mean, they can become an echo chamber to a certain point. So, like, it seems very loud because we're listening to the people who are engaged. Mm-hmm. But as you point out, I think we won't really see the true impact of this name and of this product for a couple of years yet. Like, because, you know, there's just an inherent sort of lead time involved with any type of product like this being more widely adopted across, you know, both our existing customer base and new customers that we're trying to reach with some of the things that we're doing. So, mm-hmm.
So I went and I took some of my slides where we had ASP.NET 5 sitting on top of .NET Framework 4.6 sitting on top of it. And I fixed it and I updated it to use the new ASP.NET Core naming. And it seems very clear. And everyone, you know, the majority of people are saying this makes a lot more sense. What about though MVC and Web API? Because for a while there was like MVC 5 and Web API 2.1. And what about all those kind of things on top?
Yeah, so those things kind of existed as separate things before because of the nature of how we shipped ASP.NET. So, you know, previously ASP.NET was basically a part of .NET. It was part of the .NET framework, and to get ASP.NET, you installed Windows, right? That's how you got ASP.NET because .NET framework came with Windows. And then when we wanted to do things that were extra, and like you said, built on top, we would have to create separate things. And so MVC was a separate install. First of all, we had MS Ajax. That was the first sort of OOB, as we call them, out of band product we did in 2006, I think it was. And then MS Ajax eventually rolled back in .NET 4. And then we had MVC, which we shipped in 2010, which was again built on top. And then we had SignalR and we had Web API. And these were all additional on sort of separate on top products, which, you know, kind of reflected how .NET evolved in the last 5 years. Like, NuGet didn't exist until 2011. And so, you know, before that, the way you shipped something for .NET was either you were in the GAC by way of being in the BCL, that is, you were in .NET.
You were in the global assembly cache by way of the base class library.
Yeah, or you were in the GAC because people downloaded an MSI, usually in the form of something like an SDK. You installed the foo SDK for .NET. You would run that, and that would put some other stuff in the GAC, and then you would just say add reference from, you know, the global assembly cache and Visual Studio, and that's how you would get a thing. And then with the advent of NuGet, that kind of turned everything on its head, and the concept of shipping OOB components that, you know, were really quite modular and weren't part of this monolith or even built on top of that monolith as such sort of became apparent. And so I think now with the sort of new .NET Core land where we're landing now, that is the status quo. Like, everything is modular, and, you know, our foundation right now is really just the .NET Core CLI, which is the other new thing we're doing in RC2. And we are building on top of that and a couple of other new concepts like the platform standard and standard library. And, you know, ASP.NET is basically just some API that you call from your console app. And some of that API is an MVC type of way of organizing your app. Some of it is middleware. Some of it will be Web API type model view controller things. And eventually we'll have a Signaler concept in there as well. So, you know, we'll get hubs back. And then even eventually we'll probably look at doing some type of pages framework again as well. But I don't think you'll see us talk about those as distinct products as such anymore. They'll just be other API that is under the ASP.NET umbrella that, you know, plugs into that core.
So it seems like we're trying to accomplish two different things that on first blush might seem at odds. You know, we've been talking about one ASP.NET and the idea of a unified ASP.NET for a number of years now, and that's been a kind of a goal that is a moving target. And then we're talking about making ASP.NET truly modular. If you did one of those completely, you know, if you went all modular, you know, you'd get into a different versioning, you know, SignalR is a package and this is a package and that's a package. And they're all differently versioned, which may be the underlying reality. But it seems like customers do kind of want to be able to say, yes, I'm on ASP.NET Core 1.3, and that's reliable, and I can count on it. And they don't want us to rev Web API at one speed and SignalR at another. So can you accomplish both modularity and a clean semantic versioning at the same time?
That's yet to be seen, frankly. That's something that we're still talking about. Right now, obviously, we're really focused on getting out sort of the first version of this new world. So obviously for the first version, everything will be aligned. How that goes beyond that, I'm really not ready to say yet. I mean, there are pros and cons to both approaches. And there are hybrid approaches that you can take as well, whereby, you know, people are always free to grab the latest and greatest bits, either from NuGet or even earlier, from, you know, nightly builds or MyGet builds or directly from source. And then you can do sort of a sync up cadence based release where, you know, every quarter or every 6 months, we do a sort of a suite release, and you can just, if you want to be on that train, you be on that train. Otherwise, you sort of stay on the super modular path. I'm not really sure where we're going to land yet. It'll probably be something along the lines of the hybrid model, where we enable individual bits to sort of innovate and ship on somewhat of their own schedule, but they're expected to sort of sync up and line up with a larger, you know, schedule with more fanfare, you know, for the marketing team.
That solution. I mean, you had this great slide that I've been using all over where you talked about how would you like your steak in the context of ASP.NET, you know, like rare, medium rare for things that are maybe daily builds and well done, where you're much safer. You're not going to get salmonella from a version of ASP.NET if it's one of those main cadence ones. So I like the idea of saying I can grab a daily of SignalR, but I also like the idea of once a year saying I want core 1.3 and just counting on it for a while. Almost like Ubuntu, right? Has their long-term LTS releases, their long-term serviceable releases.
Yeah, so it's a difficult problem. I mean, I think with things like Ubuntu, it's a little easier because you tend to just acquire the one thing. You just like, I install Ubuntu and I install LTS, you know, 14.04 or whatever. Mm. With ASP.NET, because the reality is now on .NET Core, you're effectively downloading 300 packages. I mean, you may acquire it as a single installer, but, you know, and under the covers, it's actually delivered in many, many hundreds of NuGet packages, all of which, you know, may have issues, and we might want to get out fixes or do rapid improvements on various little pieces of that. It is a complicated problem, and I don't think there is one solution to solve that. We still need to sort of rev on that a bit and figure out what works best for us.
I do feel like that, like, enterprises are going to want something that they can put their thumb on and say, that's the one we're going to count on for the next year or two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, our support policies will reflect that. And I think, you know, for a large portion of our customers, they acquire this stuff just through Visual Studio. And so they install a version of Visual Studio, and whatever the template gives them, you know, is what they get. And they only upgrade when they need to. Like, when they determine they have to upgrade, then they would upgrade a package or upgrade to a new version of Visual Studio. But for others, as you pointed out, they want to get their stake in a different way. Some people want to help grow the cow, which is great. In the open source world, they come in and actually, you know, send us pull requests, which is good too.
In .NET, you know, 1.2.4, the full framework, it's always been installed in C, Windows, Microsoft's .NET/framework. It's a machine level thing. People are slightly afraid of it because it involves a reboot and it changes stuff.
Yeah.
And if you update the full framework, it makes things on your computer, you know, possibly behave differently, right? You go from 4.5 to 4.6. There's a non-zero percentage that something will change. With this interstitial place, this in the middle place, this beta and these alphas and things, we had this thing called the DNX, this .NET execution environment, where it was in my users folder. And people like that. And then optionally, you could install it at the app level. So there was this kind of nice, clean scoping idea of like machine level, user level, app level. Now we've unified with the .NET team and the .NET core to the point where there'll be this .NET CLI, this command line interface. So it's going to feel more like Go and Python and things like that. Where does it live though now?
It's pretty much the same. So the thing to remember with the .NET CLI is it's, in some ways, it's a new thing, and in other ways, it's kind of broken things up even more than what DNX was. So DNX was, in actuality, somewhat of a monolith. And so when you installed DNX, you got a set of tools. Then you got DNX.exe and DNU and NVM. You got a runtime. So you got a core CLR baked away somewhere in the folder in your user's user profile. And you got a set of packages, a set of assemblies, a set of BCL bits. And they were all inside a DNX folder, which had a version. And so when you installed a different DNX, you got a new version of all three of those things. With the .NET CLI, it's very different. The .NET CLI itself is just a set of tools. It's nothing else. So a compiler and a driver and those type of things. And the tools themselves can be delivered via NuGet packages. And so at its core, the .NET CLI is practically nothing. It's really a very, very convention-driven, thin veneer. It's a command line experience, that's what's a CLI, that drives a set of tools. But they are different the runtime that you're using.
So Bash, using a Unix analogy, Bash is not grep, is not awk, is not sed. Those are the utilities that could have varying versions that you can go get a number of different ways, and Bash is the driver.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So .NET, the .dotnet that you run at the command line, isn't .NET itself.
No, .NET is a...
It's the crunchy layer outside.
It's the developer experience, right? The .dotnet is the command line developer experience, very similar to the Azure command line. In the Azure SDK, there's a set of libraries and a set of tools, and this is the tools part. And then there are other parts to what we're doing which represent the libraries, things like the .NET standard library, and then the .NET platform standard, which is an attempt to try and rationalize and simplify how we represent .NET API now that we're cross-platform. And then we have the actual runtimes themselves. So we have traditional .NET runtime, the .NET framework, which the .NET Core CLI supports. You can build apps that run on the .NET framework using .NET Core, which is why ASP.NET Core will still run on .NET framework. We have the Core CLR, which is a new runtime, which will version at its own cadence. You can build your own versions because it's open source. So we need to enable all these new scenarios that were never really a problem before, because you used to not be able to build your own version of the CLR or the garbage collector or the jitter. You can do that now. And so we need to have a command line or a development experience that can enable those things. And we need to think differently about how we deliver those pieces such that, hey, if I want to build my own jitter, I don't have to uninstall .NET on my machine and install a different one, you know.
So when you are today, before this new .NET CLI, in this beta place that we're at, there's this DNVM, .NET Version Manager. And what's nice about it, psychologically, is that you can run DNVM list, and it says, oh, you've got these five versions of the .NET framework kind of on your machine somewhere. And it's kind of comforting, because with .NET Full Framework, you can say like CLR ver, that's been a command line, and it says, oh, here are the CLRs available to you. And DNVM list was another way of saying, here they are. In this new world where there's the .NET command line tool as the SDK, is there a way to say, or do you even want to, what versions of the CLR do I have available to me?
Well, so again, the CLR itself, the runtime, will just be in a package. It's just another package that you reference from your NuGet graph. And so to say it's installed is a little of a misnomer, because it's really just another package that you reference.
But it's available. Let's say that, like, for example, it's on the disk somewhere. Is that something I'd want to ask, as opposed to I want to go up and get it from the cloud?
Maybe, but I mean, that's kind of like saying, do you want a command that says, list all the NuGet packages that I happen to have previously restored anywhere on this hard drive? You know,
but aren't they special? Isn't the CLR special? So you'd want to say .NET list.
So possibly. I mean, those packages will have a named, like a naming convention, so it'll be very easy to identify them. I'm not sure that there's going to be a first class command, at least in the first release of the .NET CLI, to list them, but some of those things are still being figured out.
Sure. I guess my question is to you is more not will there be that, but is there value in that? Am I weird to want that, given that I have it now?
I'm not going to say you're weird to want that. I can understand. But I think some of the desire with wanting that is a sort of product of how .NET has shipped in the past. And I think we need to sort of reposition how we think about the applications that we're building and how they string together now, and then re-ask some of those fundamental questions about whether it makes sense to think about the runtime and the tools and the libraries I'm using in that same way as we used to.
Right. Well, I'm imagining some future, like a year from now, right? And I've got lots of different apps on my machine, some of which use .NET full framework, like maybe I'm running Open Live Writer, some of which are .NET Core. I might have 3 or 4 locally installed web apps, and then, you know, command line utilities. And they may all use one of 3 or 4 different versions of the core CLR, including, like you said, totally custom forks of the CLR.
Yep.
Am I going to want to ask the question, like, which one does this use so that I can know the versioning? And
you'll definitely be able to do that, right? I mean, you can always type, like previously we had DNU list, which would list out all the packages a given project is referencing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there'll be a new equivalent to that. And from that, you'll be able to very easily decipher, you know, what runtime is in my package graph, which one is going to get used here.
Okay. Right?
Because there will be a set of rules that the new CLR host, which is the little bit of native code that gets copied along when you build your application so that it can boot the CLR, there'll be a set of rules that uses to determine how to find the runtime. It's somewhere in your package graph, right? And so those rules will be well documented, and you'll be able to use those rules to determine that somewhat simply.
Okay, that's good to know. That's comforting. Because I think that we've got to have one foot in the past and one foot in the future. You know, there's a certain amount of comforting that we need to do for old timers like myself. But at the same time, like you're pointing out, there's implementation details that new people just don't need to know about.
Yeah. And I mean, as I said, some of these things, you know, this isn't all set in stone. Like, so I think we'll have a story for V1, and then we will, things will adjust as necessary. Like, we're still talking right now about the concept of, shared runtimes, and what does it mean to be able to set up a server that has a version of a runtime installed and then be able to deploy applications to that server without having to push the runtime with the application, and defining that entire workflow, and you know, how do you differentiate that workflow from the default, which is just everything gets bundled up with the application and is portable. Every time we add this flexibility, we add a little bit of complexity as well, and we're trying to balance those two things.
Yeah, there was an interesting, fairly negative Medium post recently where an individual was kind of complaining about Node and how a hello world on Node. And this is in their words, brought down terabytes of packages. but at the same time, recently I noticed that on the free tier of Azure, it's very difficult and sometimes impossible to get an ASP.NET 5 app running simply because there's a lot of churning. There's a lot of disk work and a lot of bringing down of packages. And I talked to Glenn Condren, who's on our team, and it turned out it wasn't actually the size of the packages or the number of the packages. It was like the IntelliSense files for the packages that were XML files that zip up really small. So they're very small on the wire, but they end up taking up a lot of space. And that brought up another question, which is like the kinds of things that a developer wants when they bring a package down, like IntelliSense, are different from the things that you want when you throw it up on your host.
Absolutely. So there's sort of, you know, that's a classic, design time, compile time, runtime, separation. And right now we're just using NuGet packages to deliver everything. And when you say, I want this NuGet package, it has a number of different assets in it, which equate to each of those three phases. But as you point out, for something like, Azure websites, where you might be using, the Kudu based deployment, where you do a source control based deployment, your runtime environment is also a design time and compile time environment, because you're doing compilation on the server. You know, that is the deployment model when you're doing source control-based deployment. And so we have, you know, a little bit, maybe not design time. What you really need is compile time and runtime. And so the XML files are very much in the camp of, well, that's a design time feature. But when we unzip those NuGet packages, we end up like 80% of the file size is actually these XML files. And so we're making adjustments so that we can ensure that we don't do extra work that isn't necessary in certain environments.
Right. And like you said, each time you add a new thing or a switch or whatever, it's a bit of complexity. But at the same time, we've got stuff now like environments, like the concept of dev test staging or arbitrary number of environments is built into ASP.NET. So maybe we can key off of those kinds of things. And then the question is, you know, what's the default? What are smart defaults? You know, how do you just do the right thing by default without at the same time increasing the level of magic?
Yeah. And so, like, again, that's one of those balances is how much do you do by convention, which some people interpret as magic, because conventions are great when you understand the convention, but they can be somewhat of a barrier to learning when the convention isn't immediately obvious to everyone who's looking at the code for the first time.
Right.
Whereas if there's a line of code that says, you know, go and find your, you know, X-Files here. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's where the X-Files go. So, yeah, and just to comment on the environment things, one thing we also have to be careful of, obviously, is layering. The concept of environment awareness, as you talked about, is actually an ASP.NET feature purely and has nothing, you know, there's no concept of that down at the .NET layer.
Excellent
point. And so we can't always reutilize those things. And, you know, those environments were more designed and intended to be used to determine between different runtime environments. Like I am in deployment, I am on my local development machine, or I am on production. And so please at runtime do these things differently to these things. Whereas the things we're talking about are more of the traditional sort of design time, compile time, runtime phases of an application. And so we may have to have different switches, but that doesn't mean the switch can't be set multiple ways. So for example, for the XML IntelliSense file example, we may very well support an environment variable such that if an environment variable is set system-wide, so it might be on your Azure Websites machine, then NuGet by default will not, you know, extract XML files, because we just, by default, we think that's never going to be the right thing to do on that particular environment.
Right, right. And that would be something that Kudu, the deployment system, would do for you, and it would be, that would be the kind of magic that would be documented convention that would make sense to people.
Yep, absolutely.
So, last thing I wanted to cover with you is this idea of the .NET standard, and then there was also this term .NET generations. Mm-hmm. What is that?
That is an attempt on our behalf, which I hope is going to be successful, to try and simplify and put a lot more structure around the concept of what .NET API is available to me as a class library author or an application author when my code runs here or there or anywhere. So today, when you want to have the same code or indeed the same DLL, .NET DLL run on different versions of .NET or different flavors of .NET. So what we would term different platforms. So we have Windows Phone, right, supports .NET, but that is a unique and distinct platform to the Windows Store, which is distinct to .NET Framework, which is distinct to Mono, et cetera, et cetera. They're all .NET, but they don't all support the same sort of semantics, the same level of API, those type of things. So today, to represent those in Visual Studio traditionally, because this was all VS-based originally, you would choose a different project type. You would say, I want to build a Windows Phone app. And then when you did that, the, you know, IntelliSense system and the compilers behind the scenes would be driven to give you access to certain API. If you wanted to share .NET code between two of those platforms, you had a couple of choices. You could either just share the code and compile it more than once and, you know, possibly use compiler directives, which we term as ifdefs, to say only compile this code when you're on that platform and compile this code on that platform, which is a little clunky. Or then we introduce this concept of a portable class library or a PCL, which is a single .NET DLL that's designed to work on multiple platforms, and it does that by way of sort of giving you a union of the API available on those platforms. So when a new .NET platform comes along, let's say we invent a .NET fridge platform, right? Internet of Things is the hot thing right now. Mm-hmm. We would define how much API of the existing .NET-based class library is available on the fridge. We would call that .NET fridge 1.0. And then any existing library that is .NET that had been compiled would not work on that platform, right? Because the platform didn't exist. Mm-hmm. We call that a close-ended system. That is, in order for your code to run on that platform, you must have compiled for that platform. You have to have known about it ahead of time. And every time we add a platform, we have to go back and retroactively, you know, refit all the tools to know about that platform. That doesn't scale particularly well. It turns out that we tried to hide a lot of the mechanics about how that worked under the covers from people. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that with developers, that's generally never a good idea, because they very quickly fall off the nice beaten path that we've made for them. And they hit edge cases and they have to figure out how the stuff works. And then they just learn how it works anyway. And they go off and build their own tools to figure it out. So in this case, that was the concept of .NET profiles. And most very serious .NET class library authors have to learn quickly, what profiles do I have to target in order to get my code to run where I want it to run? So they very quickly have to stop thinking about where they actually want the code to run and start thinking in arbitrary profile numbers. And they are literally arbitrary, like there's profile 249 and profile 17 and profile, you know, and like there's no documentation about what these numbers represent. It's been completely reverse engineered by the community about which ones to target. So the .NET platform standard is an attempt to fix that. And the idea is to say that wouldn't it be nice if we had the concept of a .NET BCL, like a set of core API, a standard library of API, that was ever increasing. So as we versioned it, as we moved through the future, we added API. And as new platforms came on board, they could say, oh, well, .NET Fridge supports .NET Platform Standard 1.3. So if your code was compiled against .NET Platform Standard 1.3, .NET Fridge 1.0 will load it. Does that make sense? So Now we have an open-ended standard. So, you know, any code that's compiled against .NET Platform Standard, whatever, is possible and can be loaded on new platforms as they emerge based on the version of the standard that platform chooses to adhere to.
Okay. And is there like a table or, how do we explain this in boxes and lines? Where would we go to learn more about this as it gets developed?
Yeah, there are documents up on the .NET repo on GitHub. .NET, if you just search for .NET Platform Standard in your favorite search engine, you'll find the MD file in that repo that talks about it. It can be a little heavy reading. There's a bunch of terms in there that it introduces and defines. There's a bunch of history it goes over. So it may take more than one sitting to sort of read it and really understand it. And then the other problem is that it's mostly just theory right now. There's no implementation that you can download and use. That is what's coming in RC2 of .NET Core and ASP.NET Core. And so as obviously the tooling and we see more packages, you know, that are built according to this standard come on board, it'll obviously become easier to understand because, you know, it's easier to learn things when you've got some working examples.
So last question is, how panic worthy is all of this? Because people are saying, this is a complete reboot and everything that you knew and everything that you do is all thrown away. And other people are saying, well, no, this is really more of a refinement and we still know 90% of what we need to know. Like there were some angry people on Reddit were like, yeah, Microsoft keeps rewriting the APIs, blah, 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 every couple of years. Is this like complete everything is from scratch, like WinForms versus WPF? Or is this, is ASP.NET as we know it still pretty much concept the way we thought it was, and then this is just the runtime around it. Like, how freaked out should I be?
Yeah, that really depends on your perspective. It depends on how high up the stack you're observing it from, I guess it's fair to say. If you're looking at the MVC sort of concepts and APIs, a lot of those, obviously the concepts map almost one-for-one at the MVC layer, and a lot of the API maps as well. So, like, you know, we have controllers, we have views, we have filters, we have action methods, you know, all those things still exist, and a lot of the API is similar, model binding, et cetera, validation. As you move further down the stack underneath there, then you will start to see more and more changes. And so, if you go all the way down the stack to like the actual thing that's booting .NET, then obviously that's completely brand new. Not that most people have to worry about that. So I think that, you know, the higher up the stack is where most developers spend the majority of their time. And I think, if you're writing controllers and those type of things most of the time and working with EF, most of that stuff is pretty similar and will look pretty, obviously it's still C#, right?
Yeah, I think that's the other thing that you know, .NET is broadening, you know, but like, what is .NET anymore, right? .NET is not just the full framework, right? It's a whole bunch of things. But another way to look at it is C# or whatever your language of choice is. Mm-hmm. You can use it to write pretty much anything.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not always the .NET you remember, but it is still the C# or the VB or the F# that you remember.
Yeah, I think the biggest concepts in at least in ASP.NET that are going to change and be new for people are around application startup and application hosting. And so the concept of what is my web server and who is actually terminating connections is going to be different. Now we have a new web server with Kestrel and how that works with IIS. Mm-hmm. And you know, where is the code that runs, you know, starts my application and configures it? That is very new, especially if you didn't do any work with our previous Katana project where a lot of these concepts came from. So the concept of a startup CS, the concept that your ASP.NET app is really just a console app now, so you'll have a static void main that actually calls the ASP.NET hosting APIs to say, you know, please create me an ASP.NET app and configure it this way and then call run. Those are the things that will be different. And then obviously the core HTTP pipeline with the concept of middleware is very different to what we had before with modules and handlers. Once you get over that conceptual hump, I think it's you're really on a good path then to really understanding the rest of the stack.
Very cool. Well, thanks for chatting with me today.
Not a problem. Always happy to talk to you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.